The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, there's only one matter on our oral submission docket. It is, and we'll finish it before lunch. Nissan Motor Company versus Mary Armstrong from Harris County and the 14th Appellate District. Each side has 20 minutes to present oral argument. Petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal. The arguments are being recorded by the clerk, and you can purchase the tape for a small fee. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Young will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, as time permits, I propose to address three issues in argument this morning: evidence of causal defect, the other incidents evidence, and the evidence of punitive damage liability.
Could you go to the other incidents first?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The trial court admitted 775 evidence of 775 other incidents of unintended acceleration or stuck throttle. There were two problems with this evidence. First, the failure to show similarity of the incidents to the present case. And second, the fact that it was almost all hearsay. Everyone agrees about the test for admission of other incidents, that they must have involved reasonably similar but not necessarily identical circumstances. The problem is not with the definition, but with the application of that definition.
Now, you admitted exhibit number 144.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that contains hundreds of other incidents.
It contains reports of them, yes.
Okay, so
that was long after our objections to the other incident evidence had been overruled.
Well, we don't have any record of that, do we?
The
144 was pre-admitted, wasn't it? It was your own exhibit.
It was our exhibit, but it was not pre-admitted. It's pre-marked. But it was admitted.
If it were pre-admitted, would your answer be different?
I think it would.
Okay.
In the motion in limine hearings before the trial and the discussion of exhibits, does Judge Davidson pre-admit exhibits for trial? Did he pre-admit them in this case?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. I can stand to be corrected, but I don't believe so.
So they were all offered and then debated and admitted or declined to be admitted during the trial?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
The limine brief that you submitted on the other incident evidence, was that considered and ruled on?
Yes, it was, Your Honor, and the court overruled the limine on that point.
And when was that ruling?
That was pretrial, I believe, Your Honor.
So then, defendant's exhibit 144, was it admitted before or after the plaintiff's other incident exhibits?
After, Your Honor.
If that were not the case, would your answer be different? It was admitted before. My understanding was it was admitted before plaintiff's exhibit that you complain about.
Well, I guess then the question would be, was it admitted after the trial court expressed its intention to allow other incidents evidence? We believe that the reasonable similarity standard has been stretched beyond all recognition in this case. We prepared a series of charts to illustrate the problems with the other incidents evidence in this case. Turning to the first of those charts, about 30% of the other incidents, those shown in red, do not even involve cars with the challenged part. If reasonable similarity means anything in a product's case, it must mean at a minimum that the other incident must involve a product with the same challenged part as the subject product. Turning to chart two, beyond that, it must mean that there is some evidence that the challenged part was actually involved in the other incident. The record here shows that driver error is at least the predominant cause of unintended acceleration, and that there are many other potential causes. Only 8 of the 775 incidents, about 1%, those shown in blue, were arguably shown to have involved a throttle cable boot or liner. The rest establish at most the undisputed fact that unintended acceleration can happen. So only 8 of the 775 incidents were arguably shown to meet the minimum standards for relevance.
If 8 were minimally relevant, then isn't it up to you to move to redact those pieces that are not?
No, Your Honor. If the offer is of the entirety, we make an objection to the offer of the entirety. And then it is up to the proponent of the evidence to offer the limited portion that is relevant. So the burden of redaction is on the proponent of the evidence. And besides which, there were Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 had no relevant incidents. It had nothing to link the examples of unintended acceleration to any cause whatsoever. It's just unintended acceleration had allegedly happened 755 times.
When was the request made for a limiting instruction? That is, that the other incident evidence would only relate to notice.
It was made on the same day.
Assuming that's relevant.
It was made on the same day as Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 was offered. Nothing in the record shows what time of day it was made.
Was it made at the offer of the first other incident exhibit? Or was Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 not the first other incident evidence offered by plaintiffs?
It was the first first overruled hearsay objection.
I'm not sure if that answers my question.
No, it was not made at the time of the first offer of other incidents evidence. The first other incidents evidence was not hearsay, so it was not subject to a limiting instruction to prove notice. That was the 4 live witnesses. Plaintiff's Exhibit 7 was not objected to on hearsay grounds. And so it came in for the truth. But when Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 was objected on hearsay grounds and that objection was overruled, it was that same day that the limiting instruction was tendered. 771 of the 775 incidents were based on hearsay and thus not admissible to prove the truth of their contents, but at most to prove that notice was given to Nissan. Moreover, if you look at
Would you agree that they would be proper to prove that notice was given?
If, and that depends on the fourth chart, if they meet certain standards, if they meet standards of minimal relevance, and if they predate the incident in question, the sale of the vehicle. And that's my fourth chart. The fourth chart shows in blue those incidents that were reported to Nissan before this vehicle was sold and that involved a vehicle potentially with the challenged car. Now, I need to emphasize that in none of those incidents, there was no other incidents evidence reported to Nissan before the sale of the vehicle about a problem with the throttle cable and boot. So in no case was there pre-manufacture notice of the particular defect claimed by the plaintiff in this case. Not one of the 775 incidents. 464 of the incidents were after the sale of the vehicle. That's shown in red in the chart. Another 197 were before the sale of the vehicle, but involved a car that doesn't even have this part. So that brings you down to 77 to 114 that had the part and were reported before, and as I said a moment ago, of those, none was shown to involve a throttle cable and boot problem. Now, was all this harmful error? The Court of Appeals agreed with Nissan that the admission of this evidence was prejudicial to Nissan. It relied heavily on the other incidents evidence. The plaintiff did, first of all, in his opening statement, saying, we're going to bring you a lot of incidents involving the ZX. In his examination, cross-examination of witnesses, and in his closing argument, where he repeatedly referred to the over 700 incidents, the 750 incidents, and so forth, these masses of other incidents evidence created a sort of hydraulic pressure to find a defect. And that's most vividly illustrated by how it influenced the Court of Appeals.
But some of these exhibits helped you, didn't they? I mean, some of these exhibits sort of indicated that there was pedal misapplication.
I don't think any of the evidence that we're challenging indicated
No, not the ones you're challenging. But you wanted to introduce other incidents evidence of your own to show title misapplication.
Well, we introduced, and the plaintiffs introduced, some studies that showed title misapplication as the primary cause. I don't believe that any specific incidents were introduced where it was shown that, you know, incident X occurred as a result of title misapplication.
Tell me about exhibit number 145, Nissan's exhibit. Didn't that talk about other incidents in Canada?
Was that the Transport Canada report, John? That was a study done by the Canadian government. It did not talk about specific incidents except perhaps incidentally. It was a study of the overall problem rather than the circumstances of a particular accident. So it showed Transport Canada's conclusion, which matched NHTSA's conclusion, that the predominant cause was pedal error. But that was more statistical in nature than anecdotal in nature.
Was there no anecdotal evidence in that exhibit?
Have been, incidentally, some anecdotal evidence. In the course of the report, the government says, we investigated this specific incident, and here's what we found. But that was not being offered to prove that because that particular incident involved pedal error, therefore this incident involved pedal error, the way the evidence offered by the plaintiff was being offered to prove that that incident tended to show the cable throttle boot defect.
Did you make a specific limited offer?
No. And it came in without objection. The Court of Appeals placed heavy reliance on the other incidents evidence for a multiple number of purposes. First, as important proof of causation. Just like the old TV commercial, 9 out of 10 doctors can't be wrong, the Court of Appeals reasoned that 775 drivers can't all be guilty of pedal error without any basis for drawing that inference. It relied on the evidence as support for the punitive damage finding, even though, as we've seen, the majority of the evidence even postdated the sale of the vehicle. And it relied on the evidence as rendering Mr. Meisen's testimony harmless. Absence of proof of similarity went by the board. Absence of relevant timing went by the board. It is as though the other incident's evidence created its own unintended acceleration toward affirmance of a judgment against Nissan. And the final point, it was not just a few other incidents that caused this. It was what the Court of Appeals called the mountain of other incidents, what plaintiff's counsel closed in closing argument, the 700 to 750 incidents. Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 was clearly objected to on both hearsay and relevance grounds, and those objections were clearly overruled in the record. So regardless of anything else, it was that addition of 750 incidents that created the possibility for the Court of Appeals to reason, for plaintiffs to argue that there was a mountain of other incidents out there. So it was harmful even if the others were not. Turning briefly to punitive damage liability, the test is well known. The defendant's actual subjective knowledge at the time of its conduct that the conduct creates an extreme risk of serious injury. There is no evidence in this record of any unintended acceleration or stuck throttle incident attributed to the cable and boot assembly reported to Nissan before the sale of plaintiff's car. The plaintiffs rely on a snippet of testimony at pages 252 and 253 of the record, but we believe that they mischaracterize that testimony, and if the court examines it carefully, we'll see that it does not support notice to Nissan before the sale of the vehicle of a throttle boot problem. Even if it did, it would show at most one incident out of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of cars, not shown to result in any injury, much less a serious injury. And so there is no basis for the jury to infer actual knowledge of an extreme risk of serious injury. With that, I believe I'll end my argument unless the court has any questions, subject, of course, to rebuttal.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from Mr. Brown.
May it please the court, Mr. Grant Kaiser and Mr. Donald Wilhelm will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Kaiser will open for the first 19 minutes.
May it please the court, I can't tell you what an honor it is to be here and have the court set aside the whole morning for just us to hear this this case. It's very, very nice. I do hope to get finished for lunch. suspect the court wants to hear about seven deceleration incidents first. Is that the thing that's what your focus was?
Yes.
I'll go directly to that then. The question was asked, when was Defendant's Exhibit 44 admitted? That was admitted pre-trial, and it was actually admitted over our objection, which is noted in our motion in limine. The motion in limine, which includes the order, yes or no, under each point there. And it was offered and admitted pre-trial, according to the clerk's record at 346, which is a list of all the exhibits, when the objections were made, and what the ruling was.
Is there a reporter's record for the? Is there a reporter's record on the pretrial admissions?
Yes. Page.
You said clerk's record.
I'm sorry.
Was there a court reporter there?
No.
Okay.
This was off the record, pretrial, you know, before the jury comes in. That kind of, you know how it works. You were there.
No, wait. I used to try the cases at trial.
How can you admit an exhibit off the record? I mean, that's what the record's for, to show whether it was admitted.
Well, there was a written record made of it.
Trial judge signed an order.
Well, this is from the defendants himself. Their chart.
The trial judge has got to order. The trial judge order has to be written or on the record. As far as I know, that's all there is, right?
Yes, sir.
So which one was it? It wasn't on the record court reporter, and that's not signed by the trial judge.
This is not signed by the trial judge, but, you know, it's signed by the defendants, offered by the defendants. The fact that we objected to it in our motion in limine, and the fact that it came in early, supports the concept that I'm trying to make here.
Kaiser, were you trial counsel?
No, I was not. Mr. Wilhelm and Mr. Sherr were trial counsel. I was appellate counsel before the judgment's entered.
Mr. Young gave me his belief about what happened pre-trial. Were most of the exhibits or all of the exhibits pre-admitted before the trial started?
Absolutely. And that's what...
So in typical fashion, did the judge go through the plaintiff's exhibits first and then the defendant's exhibits?
Yes.
So the plaintiff's exhibits, including exhibits 27 and 7 and the subparts to 7, were admitted before you got to 144 or not?
27 was not admitted until page 1200 of the record, I believe. And it wasn't admitted in our case in chief. It was admitted cross-examination of defendant's expert to rebut his testimony and Nissan's official position that all these incidents occurred because of pedal error and that they had fully investigated every one of them and there was no problem. That was those were the precise purposes for which it was offered. If you read the testimony, it comes right in sequence of that, and Mr. Hughes is their expert. And that's why it was offered. Nissan's opening statement. Let's talk, you know, if they talk about incidents and what they're going to prove. Got another question?
Go ahead. Finish that thought. That's my question.
This is Nissan's lawyer. Let me visit with you about what Nissan did in response to other incidents. Nissan investigated these incidents, did a thorough investigation, thorough engineering analysis, and determined that no defect existed. The incidents were primarily due to mistake, a pedal misapplication. And that was their position in opening statement. That was their position all the way through trial. Mr. Hughes, their expert, record at 1164. Sir, isn't it Nissan's official position on all sudden acceleration claims? Yes, I'm sorry. But you made it clear in their opinion there was no component failure. Right, answer yes. I believe I testified there was no evidence of a components failure on the vehicle. Question, sir, isn't that Nissan's official position on all sudden acceleration claims? Answer, I believe that the most probable cause of sudden acceleration or unintended acceleration was pedal misapplication. I believe that every case that I am aware of has resulted from pedal misapplication. Then we get in with Plaintiff's Exhibit 27. How does 27 prove it's not pedal misapplication?
I understand that thought. Let me go back to the pre-admission.
Yes,
Plaintiff's Exhibit 7 and the subparts, were they pre-admitted before trial?
No, they were admitted during trial.
During trial?
They were admitted during Mr. Meisen, which is our expert's testimony. They were admitted. One second, let me get you the site on that. They were admitted on page 718 of the record. And let me show you how that was done.
I'll go back and read the record rather than ask you to use your valuable time reading parts of the record.
Sure.
The motion in limine brief in which Nissan argued that this other incident evidence should not come in. When was that considered and ruled on?
There is no ruling in the record that I'm aware of on that. I think what happened was, as normal trial judges go, and almost everybody here has been trial judges, that let's take them as we get to them. I'm not going to make a blanket ruling right now. Let's see what the proof is. You know, Judge Davidson's a senior guy in Houston, and so many of you work with him, and know that he's methodical and careful and makes a good record, and he's only been reversed twice, and I hope this is not the third, because he'll certainly kill me for it. So that's what happened, Your Honor.
So there was no ruling in the record, was the word you used. So
right.
There was no ruling during pretrial on the motion in limine to exclude other incident evidence, is what you're saying the record will show us when we
Well, right, there's no ruling on their motion, yes. Now, there are rulings on exhibits, which you can infer, you know, that he in part overruled their objections, motions, our motion in limine objections. It was a beginning of a, you know, what's the court going to do with these kind of things when you get there? Defense wants this in, plaintiff wants this in. We didn't want the report, defendant's 144 in, to show they could get up and say, the government investigated this, there's no problem, you know. We didn't want that in, but they wanted it in, it got in. They didn't want our incidents in, where we found throttle boot problem. We had live witnesses come to trial at their own expense to testify about it. They didn't want that in.
Yeah, they have argued that the reason that's in is because they were gutted during pretrial and they had no choice. Can you respond to that?
It's just not supported by the evidence or the record. Again, Defendant's Exhibit 144 was what they wanted in from the outset, and it only makes sense. A reasonable trial lawyer defending the company would want to say the government has investigated this and found no defect. That is a critical principal argument and the reason why there's no gross negligence here. You know, to say that that was just an afterthought and came in after plaintiff's exhibits is not supported by the record, is the kindest way I can say it. Now, they also claim in their brief that they didn't have to make objections, basically. They're using this shorthand to refer back to other objections that were in writing or something else. But if you look at what the record is, page 718 of the record, this is when most of the 7 series came into evidence. They're all offered, and the court says, your sole objection to these is relevance. And Nissan's lawyer says, on the grounds previously stated, the court, relevance? Nissan's lawyer, time periods. The court, overruled. The objection as stated is overruled. Okay? Now, that was just on a couple of the 7 issues. They had no objection to other of the 7 series incidents. Were there any other 7 exhibit series, this is the court, offered that no objection was made? Mr. Wellham, there was no objection, I believe, to 7DLM. Nissan, that is correct, Your Honor. So, number one, we're not dealing with some shorthand code word about what these objections mean. The court at every instant when there was an objection made about other incidents says, what is your objection? You know, and so there's another incident when Exhibit 27 came in. Same thing. What is your objection? And it shows that they not only agreed to have these other incidents admitted, they had no objection to these. How could they object? The reason they didn't object is because they knew they were substantially similar. They knew that they...
Was there a brief filed prior to trial by Nissan? Was there a brief filed prior to trial on these evidentiary matters relating to the admission of these, what they consider to be not similar incidents?
There was a 2 or 3 page motion. I would call it a brief, but yes, it was a written motion. Yes, sir.
There was no brief. I thought there was a brief. I thought they had a brief detailing why they thought this evidence should not come in. Is that not correct?
I don't recall that. I could stand corrected on, but I certainly don't recall.
And if there was a three-page motion filed prior to trial that objected to this evidence coming in, how many times during trial do they have to renew that objection? Is it your contention they've got to, every time it's mentioned, they've got to make another objection?
Well,
was it preserved by that motion?
It was not preserved by the motion because there's no ruling on that motion. Like I said, the court says, let's take them as we come to them. I'm not going to make a blanket ruling right now. I don't have the time to, let's go through each of these incidents right now. Let me hear what the evidence is, and then I'll make my ruling. There's no ruling that they can rely on.
What was the chronology of Nissan's attempts to get a limiting instruction to the jury?
Thank you
Did
for asking.
Did that come much later, or was it going along at the same time as this?
Never. The record is totally void of any evidence whatsoever that a limiting instruction was requested at all, or that a ruling was obtained, both of which are required for preservation of error. Now, there is a limiting instruction in writing in the record, in the court reporter's record, in the clerk's record, sorry. That, according to Nissan's argument, was filed, and all, that's all we can say, it was filed on the day that Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 was admitted. Okay, so that was Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 was on page 1200 of the trial. So, and the record is totally silent at the time that the 7 series was entered, Defendant's Exhibit 144 was entered, Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 was entered, admitted into evidence. Each time those things were admitted, no request under Rule 104 for limiting instruction.
What would it have been limited to, I wonder?
It could have been limited to a lot of things.
Well,
if it had been.
Suggest so.
Sure. They could have said, well, Judge, this evidence has not been shown substantially similar enough to this case as proof of the dangerousness of the defect presented by a stuck rod.
So we want it limited to what?
We want it to, for purposes only for notice.
Notice of what?
Notice that these types of incidents, these substantially similar incidents occurring with 300 ZXs, have the same throttle cable design. And
does it have to be before sale?
For notice purposes, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, notice after the sale.
They say they don't have any of those. They say there's no pre-manufactured notice of cable boot defect.
Thank you for asking that, too. Page 182 of the record. The question of Mr. Yakushi, who's the top engineer at Nissan. Top engineer. He participated with the government. He was the government's guy, or the guy that did all the technical stuff for the government and its investigation. Question, when did you first learn that the protective cap may cause a throttle to stick in the wide open now that you have the benefit of reviewing the documents? In other words, this is a deposition being read into the record at trial. He would appear at trial, interestingly. And that's another story. But he's being presented with these other incidents in his deposition, and, you know, basically we call it making him eat those. And as you know,
were any of them pre-manufactured? That's what I'm asking.
But answer, I don't recall when I would have been made aware of this, but it probably would have been sometime in 84 based on the date of the document.
Well, but I was wondering about that document.
Plaintiff's Exhibit 65.
His Plaintiff's Exhibit 65 is a pre-manufacturer indication of a cable boot defect.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And, you know, and I understand the court wanting the most precise evidence it can get about pre-sale actual knowledge.
But you do agree it needs to be pre-sale notice.
For what purpose?
Any purpose.
What if it's for notice, yeah.
And what exactly does a limiting instruction do? Say 699 of the 700 incidents are not similar. What would your limiting instruction say? We want a limiting instruction saying those 699 are irrelevant?
Well, that's...
I mean, limiting instruction is fine when you're saying, jury, only consider this for notice. But their objection is, these are not notice of this incident because they're different. how would your limiting instructions say, jury, don't consider the 699 because, of course, they're dissimilar?
Well, the problem is they didn't object on the basis that it wasn't similar. They're here saying it was hearsay.
So it's not a matter of limiting instruction. It doesn't matter about limiting instruction.
If I had been on the other side, I would have requested a limiting instruction every time one of these came in to try to limit the evidence, and that's what Rule 105.
Well, but Rule 105 says limiting instructions when it's admitted for one purpose but not admissible for another purpose or for another party. We're not talking about that. Their objection is these aren't admissible for any purpose for any party because they're after the sale.
So that really
wouldn't be a limiting instruction question.
Not if you're talking about a hearsay objection, right?
And if the hearsay objection was improperly overruled, you don't have to ask for limiting instruction, do you? I mean, if it had been sustained, then you would have to ask for limiting instruction to get it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you don't have to preserve error. Once you say hearsay overruled, you don't have to ask for limiting instruction to preserve error, do you?
Right, and that relates only to Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 is the one they talked about hearsay on. And I put a chart.
The 27
objection.
Is where the 700 and some odd came in.
Right, to rebut their position that all of these things are caused by pedal error. And the way Plaintiff's Exhibit 27 does that is that it has all these data fields in it, and it shows that 66 of these incidents in 300 ZXs with the same throttle design that caused sudden acceleration, unintended acceleration, occurred after Nissan installed the shift interlock system.
But that was all hearsay.
No.
It was objected to.
I disagree, Your Honor. And the reason I disagree is that the evidence establishes how that database was created. It was created by Nissan. The data was collected by a checklist that was developed through the engineering mind of Mr. Yakushi, their principal engineer.
Did it come in as a business records exception?
The ruling was objection overruled.
Came in under several exceptions?
Absolutely.
How is it an admission? I mean, if you're just reporting what your mail says, and the objection is that's hearsay, how is that an admission?
First, if I could, I don't think they're just reporting what the mail says. That's what they say in their brief, but the record doesn't support that. What they are is, like I was trying to establish, is that they developed this database themselves. They decided what data to collect, and they collected the data through technical service managers who were specially trained in sudden acceleration incidents.
So if somebody went out, some nefarious person, to stir up a claim and paid people $1,000 each to call in Nissan and make the following complaint, then if Nissan writes that down, it's coming into evidence because they wrote it down. That's why we have that hearsay rule, because those kind of things can happen, right? And we want that person there, so we say, when did that actually happen?
I understand.
So,
I understand. You're right, but that's not what happened here.
Well, I understand.
But yes, you're exactly right in that situation.
Petitioners argue there's an analytical gap that in the expert's testimony that a frayed cable liner or a hardened boot, either one, may cause the engine acceleration to stick at a certain level, but won't cause it to race uncontrollably. Therefore, they argue that a light touch on the accelerator is not going to cause an uncontrolled acceleration of the vehicle. Is there a gap there, and if not, why not?
Absolutely not. There's not a gap. May I continue?
Yes.
There's not a gap there for several reasons. Number one, you didn't need an expert to find this. And how do we know this? It's because customers were writing in to Nissan, telling them, sending them pictures of the problem they had with their car. So my first response is, who cares about the expert? It's happening. They know it's happening. We can prove it that way. But
so
I will get to your point.
Understandably, you agree with the Court of Appeals that expert testimony is not required here.
Absolutely. But we have it anyway. And what we know is that Mr. Meisen, our expert, used the same methodology of analyzing this sudden acceleration than Nissan did. There's a checklist on tab 3. There's a flow chart about how to do this. The first mechanical issue there is check the throttle. So they use the same methodology. There's no gap. The barely press the throttle. Is that where you want me to go? The barely press the throttle is somewhat of a misleading thing, because if you look at the entire page in context, this is a cross-examination. You barely press the pedal, right? Because you're in a tight space. You know, the space wasn't any bigger than this court. A small parking lot, tree, building. You wouldn't have pressed it. And then the next question is, what I'm trying to get at is you wouldn't have pressed it, you know, halfway down to the floor in this small situation here, because it would have been overkill. And so what the testimony establishes is that she stepped on the gas, which is absolutely, you know, required for this defect to happen because of the boot scum slide board, and that it was somewhere between half and barely touching it. And that's what the purpose of the cross-examination was there. And they want to harp on just the first part without looking at the context.
Let me.
So if I'm just to clarify, your contention is to say that she barely touched the accelerator pedal is a mischaracterization of her testimony and context. What she did was pressed it maybe as much as halfway down.
Well, it's somewhere between half and you know, barely touching, you know, means.
So maybe as much as halfway down.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm a little bit confused about the pretrial proceedings. They claim that their Exhibit 144 was offered at trial and admitted because they had been overruled during pretrial. Is there any order that excludes or tells us what comes in or doesn't come in?
The only thing that's going to – an order admitting or excluding evidence, no.
Well, or overruling or sustaining objections.
A motion limiting?
Is that the only motion we're talking about?
They did file a motion to exclude some other things, but like I said, there was never a ruling on it. And the judge says, let's take these as we get to them. I'm not going to make a blanket ruling right now that nothing comes in or everything comes in. Let me exercise some discretion and hear what the evidence is.
Now, my understanding is they claim that was their objections were overruled, but we don't have any record of that. So I think their argument is that having the motion to exclude with no record ruling on it, the fact the trial court then admitted it is an indication that it was then overruling the motion.
Well, it admitted their exhibit over our objection. He admitted defendant's exhibit 144, which was the first evidence.
No, I understand, but my understanding... Their premise is they admitted it because their motion to exclude had been overruled, and since all jurors was coming in, they were going to admit theirs, is the way I understand their argument. I'm trying to get back to where that might have happened in the record.
It didn't.
But again, I think their argument is that although there's no ruling on the record on their motion to exclude, by then letting these exhibits come in, the court implicitly overrules their objections.
No, none of them came in until we laid our correct. The 7 series, they didn't come in pretrial. They came in during Mr. Meisner's testimony. So that doesn't make any sense. It's not logical. That they say 144 was admitted pretrial. It was admitted pretrial over our objection, our motion limiting. I know that doesn't preserve any error, and we're not here claiming it does. But the point is, we objected to it because we didn't want them to get there and say, government should look to this, no problem. That's what they did. And we countered with it. But our evidence of other incidents was admitted during the trial. Judge Davidson did not rule that our evidence was coming in pre-trial. He ruled that theirs was. Defendants did 144. He overruled our limine, and so it's in. And that's what their own records reflect in the court's record. Court's record, sorry. I can't get used to these new terms. Well,
any other questions?
Yeah.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Manager.
May it please the court. Justice Jefferson, our other incidents brief appears at page 142 of the clerk's record, and it is 15 pages plus exhibits. Justice O'Neill, I checked, and there is no anecdotal evidence in either Defendant's Exhibit 144, which is the NHTSA closing report, or Defendant's Exhibit 145, which is the Transport Canada report. Justice Hecht, the 1984 knowledge to which counsel referred, as shown in Plaintiff's Exhibit 65, is evidence of a different type of incident. That was an incident where a foreign object became lodged in the throttle manifold, which is the actual internal part with the butterfly valve that lets the air in. It is not the crank on the outside of the throttle that the cable winds around that is claimed to be the defect in this case.
What was the foreign object?
The foreign object was a 35 millimeter diameter protective cap. The 35 millimeter diameter does not correspond to the throttle boot on this vehicle that the plaintiff claims is defective. So some kind of 35 millimeter diameter protective cap got inside the throttle mechanism, where the claim here is that a throttle boot, differently shaped, got in the outside of the throttle mechanism.
Was Exhibit 144 admitted over Armstrong's objection? I mean, did you want that in?
We did want that in. Let me try and clarify what I believe is the sequence of events on the admission of evidence.
So, well, let me just ask you this. If you wanted it in, then you don't deny that it was admitted pretrial or really care when it was admitted.
That's right, because among other things, it does not have other incidents evidence of the kind we're objecting to. So I don't even see why the timing of its admission and the circumstances of its admission make any difference to the alleged claim.
So for purposes of our argument then, it was admitted by Nissan without objection, and we don't need to presume that it was overruled, but Nissan's objections were.
I think that's right. I think the sequence of events is both parties filed motions in limine. There is no ruling on those motions in the record that I can find. The plaintiff's motion has various check marks, granted and denied, but is not signed by the judge. Then a lot of the exhibits are
but
just...
The limine motion is never a ruling on evidence anyway. It just says approach the bench before you admit it.
That is correct, Your Honor, but you heard counsel argue that his objection was preserved by his motion in limine. What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
Well, I didn't hear him say that. I just heard him say that 144 came in and it was similar other incidents evidence.
Well, I believe he said he objected to it, but whether he
did
or not, I don't know. I don't know that that matters. Plaintiff's Exhibit 27, we heard, was offered to rebut evidence that all these incidents were puddle error and that they were thoroughly investigated. First of all, Nissan has never claimed that all the incidents are pedal error. Nissan's engineer, Yaguchi, testified that there are many other potential causes. All of those that Nissan was able to determine a cause for were either pedal error or some other non-defect explanation, such as interference by floor mats and so forth. As far as some incidents occurring after the shift interlock campaign, the Transport Canada report shows quite clearly that after the shift interlock campaign, the number of incidents plummeted but did not go to zero, because there were many instances where the shift interlock was not actually installed. The customer did not come into the dealership in response to the recall and have it installed. And there were also some cases where it was improperly installed. So the fact that there were continuing to be incidents after the shift interlock campaign really proves nothing. Finally, with respect to the issue of causation, there is simply no evidence in this record that the hypothesized causal mechanism, the cable boot becoming detached and getting stuck in the bell crank, actually happened in this case. If this were a toxic torque case, we would say there is general causation evidence. That kind of thing can happen and cause a stuck throttle. But there is no specific causation evidence, either direct or circumstantial, that actually is what happened.
Any other questions?
Yeah, just briefly, Chief, if I could. The intrigued by the trial courts and court of appeals remittiture, you all didn't ask for it. Couldn't ask for it because you stipulated the $2 million was just fine.
We stipulated we wouldn't appeal it.
That's right. So normally even constitutional errors can be waived if nobody objects.
Right. But the parties cannot, by a stipulation, irrevocably bind the trial court.
No, of course not. But also, can trial courts, I mean, if no objection or argument is needed, I suppose we could cut the punitive damages or perhaps raise them to you all's great surprise while the case is here on appeal.
Well, this court does not have remittive jurisdiction, but the Court of Appeals, I don't know if the Court of Appeals can sua sponte order or reverse and remittive. I know the trial court.
The trial judge did.
The trial judge did and can.
Because?
We don't have in the record why he did. One has to assume that he followed the Pope versus Moore standards.
So even though there's no objection that it's either unconstitutional or factually insufficient, trial judge can just spring it on you.
That's right, subject to review on cross appeal, as happened here. And there was no preservation of this point by the plaintiffs in the trial court.
Well, it was a surprise to them. You didn't ask for it, and they didn't.
But
it just happened.
It happened during the trial court's plenary power, and they never told the trial court you can't do this.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments for today, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oye, oye, oye.